So suppose that you have a Clausius manifold, then a special Lagrangian submanifold is a, well, it's a submanifold whose dimension is half the dimension of the Clausius, so M contained in X. The real dimension of M is the same as the complex dimension of X. And the Kähler form, we're assuming we have a Ricci flat metric on X, the Kähler form on X restricts to zero on M, so that's omega. And the imaginary part of a holomorphic N form also restricts to zero on M. Okay, so that's the definition. These are volume minimizing objects. They're very difficult to actually find examples of. There are a few ways of getting examples and a few known examples, but after even 8 years after the Strom-Zhao-Zassel conjecture was first made, we still don't really have any good idea of how to construct them. So what was the Strom-Zhao-Zassel conjecture? That was made in 1996. And what this says very loosely is that if you have a pair X and check X of a mirror pair of Clausius manifolds, then there exists dual special Lagrangian torus vibrations. So in other words, you have these maps from X to B and X check to B, where B is the same base in both cases. And the fibers of this map are special Lagrangian tori. And these special Lagrangian tori should be dual in some sense, which will get a bit more precise. And that this should explain how to construct mirror pairs of Clausius, if one understands this well. Of course, some fibers of this map should be singular. Otherwise, if all the fibers were actually tori, you wouldn't have any interesting topology. The Euler characteristic would be zero, and you wouldn't have any of the interesting Clausius threefold, say, that you would want to see a mirror symmetry. So what you would expect is that you would have some locus B0 contained in B, where the fibers are non-singular, and then you'd have a discriminant locus delta, where you have singular fibers for the special Lagrangian torus vibration. So B0 itself is a moduli space for special Lagrangian submanifolds in N, in X, a moduli space of deformations of a given special Lagrangian torus. And as soon as you have a moduli space of special Lagrangians, it comes along with some nice structures that were discovered by McLane and then clarified by Hitchin. So there are various structures on the special Lagrangian moduli space. The first one, and the one that's going to be most important for us, is an affine structure. So in other words, the moduli space B0 has atlas with charts whose transition functions are all in the affine group of Rn. So it's an n-dimensional manifold. Actually, it's a bit better than F of Rn. Next slide. What you actually get is an affine structure on B0 with transition maps in Rn semi-direct product GLN Z. So in other words, the linear part of the affine transformation is integral. Okay, so that's something you always get for free when you have a moduli space of special Lagrangians as one of these affine structures. You also get a metric on the alpha on B0 as a metric that's said to be in Hessian form. So in other words, if you have affine coordinates y1 through yn, so in other words, coordinates with respect to one of these nice charts, then you can write the metric in terms of a potential function k, and the Gij is just the Hessian of the potential function k. And K will be locally defined on the affine manifold, so various pieces of K can be glued together, and you get a multivalued function on all of B0, multivalued potential. You can view that as somewhat analogous to a Kähler potential on a complex manifold. So that metric is usually known as the McLean metric. A second, the third bit of data you get is actually a second affine structure. But this data actually follows from the first two bits, because you can construct the affine coordinates with respect to the third. You can construct the affine coordinates with respect to the second affine structure by just differentiating the potential. So in other words, yi hat is the first derivative of k with respect to yi. That gives you coordinates y1 hat through yn hat, which are coordinates in the second affine structure. And the transition maps in the second affine structure are essentially the dual transition maps to the first ones in the first affine structure. That's a slightly complicated relationship. And also, the metric g we have on the original b0 can also be written in this new affine structure. Can be written in terms of a new potential k hat. So with respect to the new coordinates, gi hat, j hat is the Hessian of k hat, where k hat is the Lejeune transform of the original k. So in other words, k hat is sum from I equal 1 to n, yi hat minus k, evaluated at y1 through y. But just the Lejeune transform of k. Okay, so that's the structure that you're given when you're dealing with special Lagrangian moduli spaces. Now, the basic philosophy that's been developing over the last 8 years as we come to understand the SYZ conjecture more is that it seems to be a very difficult problem. It's difficult to construct special Lagrangians. It's difficult to construct vibrations of special Lagrangians. But on the other hand, the structures that appear in the moduli space are perhaps more essential to thinking about mirosymmetry than the special Lagrangian vibrations themselves. And we have a much better hope of actually getting our hands on these structures in the moduli space without knowing that the vibration itself exists. So that's the philosophy here. So it's too hard, but B can be understood. So let me, to sort of illustrate a toy version of this, let me give a toy version of mirosymmetry that works well. So what we're going to do is we're going to forget about the metric aspects of the conjecture and just work with the affine structure that we have on the on B0, so on the first affine structure. So let's start with just a B0, which is just an affine manifold with transition maps and Rn, semi-direct product GLNZ. So transition maps between charts are the form AX plus B, where A is integral, A is GLNZ. Okay, so once you have this restriction, then you can define a family of lattices in the tangent bundle of B0 as follows. If you have affine coordinates Y1 through Yn, then the tangent vectors ddy1 through ddyn generate a lattice inside the tangent bundle. And the point is that this lattice doesn't depend on the choice of affine coordinates. You make a change of affine coordinates, so a change of coordinates with using an element in Rn semi-direct product GLNZ, then the all you end up doing is replacing this basis for the lattice with a equivalent basis for the same lattice. It's just an integral change of basis, not a change of basis over R. So you get the same lattice. So as a result, you have a globally defined family of lattices in the tangent bundle of B0, and then you immediately get a torus bundle out of that by dividing out the tangent bundle by this family of lattices. So you have a torus bundle sitting over B0. So that gives you a TN bundle. And this torus bundle actually carries with it a natural complex structure. So I've tried to draw what the complex structure is doing. What you're the almost complex structure J, the multiplication by I in the tangent space, is just interchanging the horizontal and vertical tangent spaces at a point in the tangent bundle of B zero. Of course, you have to put in a minus sign, so J squared will be negative. But the horizontal tangent spaces are the horizontal tangent spaces with respect to the flat connection defined by the affine structure. Okay, so this actually gives you an integrable complex structure on x of b zero. So whenever you have one of these affine manifolds, you get for free a complex manifold. Now J is interchanging them, so the I eigenspace is something like a vertical plus I times a horizontal. Well, that's you see, when you're choosing the affine structure to be in Rn semi-direct product GLMZ, it means that you're really choosing some integral structure on Rn already to be able to talk about Zn setting inside Rn. So that's the choice. And generally, if you have an affine manifold that's integral in this sense, it will be integral with respect to some particular choice of integral structure on Rn. But that's really the only choice. Okay, so dually, what you can do is take in the cotangent bundle, you have a dual lattice lambda to check, which is generated by dy1 through dyn, where again y1 through yn are local affine coordinates. And again, because of this integrality of the affine structure, you get a well-defined global lattice inside the cotangent bundle, and you can again divide out by that lattice, and you get a torus bundle over B0 again. And these two torus bundles are clearly dual. And this is the sense in which Stromberg-Yau-Zassala conjecture says that torus vibration should be dual to get mirror symmetry. Yeah? Yes, it is. I mean, that's. No, it's fine. I mean, if you change the coordinates, the affine coordinates, the complex coordinates change in a similar way. I could go into more detail. Sorry. Is it all right? Yeah. Right. I mean, both the vertical and horizontal tangent spaces are canonically isomorphic to the tangent space at the point. Okay. So on the on this X check of B0, there's a symplectic structure because the cotangent bundle of a manifold always contains a canonical symplectic form, and that descends the quotient. So that gives you actually a symplectic manifold, and now the torus bundle is actually Lagrangian. So we're not seeing special Lagrangian because we're ignoring the metric, but at least on one side you see Lagrangian, and in some sense on the other side you see a special vibration. So this correspondence between x of b0 and x check of b0 is a good toy version of mirror symmetry. It gives you a good hint as to what's going on in mirror symmetry. So there is a very simple example you can take. Let's take just take Rn, which is itself an affine manifold with one chart, and divide out by lattice gamma. So you just take gamma containing Rn a lattice. So that means B, which is in this case the same as B0, is a compact torus, and X of B is a complex torus, and X check of B is a symplectic torus. Now, if you want to get a full version of mirror symmetry, you should decorate these constructions a little bit by twisting by a B field, or including the B field, which means twisting the complex structure on X of B. But let me show you two slightly more interesting examples. These should be quite familiar to many people by now, these pictures. Let me start with a two-dimensional example. What you do is you start by taking a polytope, say a reflexive polytope in R3. In this case, I'm going to take the reflexive polytope which corresponds to the quartic in P3 in the matter of mirror symmetry construction. So that's the polytope, which is the convex hull of these 4 points, minus 1, minus 1, minus 1, 3, minus 1, minus 1, and so on. Now, the manifold B will take to be just the boundary of this polytope, the boundary of C. And that, of course, is homeomorphic to S2. And what I've done is I've drawn in this picture, I've drawn the polytope, and I've drawn some red points. The blue points, there are the integral points on the edges and vertices of the polytope, so those points with integer coefficient coordinates. And in between each pair of integral points on the edges, I take one point in delta. So in other words, I'm going to remove those points, those red points, the little red X's, to get B0. Okay, so now if I want to actually define a an affine structure on B0, I need to do this. I'm going to do this very explicitly using charts. The open cover I'm going to use to cover B0 is, first of all, I'm going to take the interior of the two-dimensional faces. That clearly doesn't cover all of B0, though. And then I also take neighborhoods of the integral vertices that I've drawn, the blue points. So I've drawn here some neighborhoods of each of the integral points. And these neighborhoods should be such that they don't include any of the red points. This should be just a covering of B0. And then it's clear that with the interiors of the two-dimensional faces and the neighborhoods I've drawn around each of the integral points, that together should cover B0. So that's what I'll use for my open covering, and I just need to define an affine coordinates on each set in the open covering. Okay, so here are the charts. For each of the two-dimensional faces, we have the open set consisting of the interior of that two-dimensional face. And that's sitting naturally inside a affine plane inside R3, so that gives us an affine coordinates on that plane, affine coordinates on that interior of that face. Okay, so that's the first chart. The second chart, what we do is for each integral point V on the edge, we have a little open neighborhood of V, let's call it UV. And we're going to define affine coordinates on UV just by projecting from V onto R3 mod RV. And you can check that that's actually a good coordinate chart on UV. And it's pretty easy to see that the transition maps between these coordinate charts is affine. But the thing is that the affine structure we've defined has some singularities. You can't extend it across the red points. And that's because there's holonomy in the affine, in the flat affine connection. So if you take a look at this picture again, if you just go follow a little loop around one of these singular points, and if you follow the affine coordinates we've defined, if you choose them correctly, you'll find that a pair of coordinates y1, y2 gets replaced as you go around the loop. When you get back to the beginning, you'll end up getting coordinates y1, y1 plus y2. And as a result, you can't extend those coordinates across the singular point. I'll never be defined everywhere, well defined everywhere. Okay, so a few basic facts about this example. It's very easy to compactify x of b0 to a k3 surface topologically. However, we can't do it as a complex manifold. It's also pretty easy to compactify x check of b0 to a symplectic k3 manifold. K3 surface. So let me do quickly another example. Let's go one dimension up. This time we'll take the polytope corresponding to the quintic in P4, so it's the convex hull of these 5 points, R4. Again, we'll take B to the B, the boundary of this polytope. It's a simplex, so we just get a sphere, again, S3. And this one is much harder to draw. So what I'll do is, instead of drawing the whole thing, is first I'll just draw one of the two faces of the polytope. So there's a two-face, and again, I've indicated the integral points in there. I then choose a triangulation. It doesn't really matter how I do this, but I choose a triangulation of this two-face using only the integral points that we have as vertices. And once we've done that, then I can describe the discriminant locus. I'll draw the discriminant locus here. Well, I've just drawn it. I prescribe, yes. Okay. This is the discriminant locus. I'm going to call this the discriminant locus. So again, it's the things in red. I've drawn it wiggly to sort of indicate that I don't really care exactly where I put it, other than it has to be in the plane of this face. I've also drawn at the edges, I've drawn these trivalent vertices, but you should keep in mind that each edge, of course, is contained in three different two faces, and so you have two red edges going off into those other two faces. So this picture at the edges isn't planar. Okay, so again, we can define some affine charts. So on the interior of a three-dimensional face of this polytope, we just use the fact that sitting inside an affine 3-plane inside R4, that defines an affine chart or affine coordinates on the interior of the three-face. And then in the neighborhood of each integral point, V in a two-face, we take some small neighborhood of that integral point, call it UV, just as we did before for the K3 example, and we project from that vertex into R4 mod RV, and that gives us a second chart, this time in the neighborhood of each vertex. And so that defines an affine structure everywhere but along the red lines. Now, again, this should be familiar to many of you already, but the behavior you get near the discriminant locus, if you take a look at the holonomy of the affine structure near the discriminant locus, there are essentially two different sorts of behaviors. There is the vertices contained in the interior of a two-face, where you might get holonomy looking as I've just drawn here. You get a two-dimensional space of invariant, and that corresponds to the two-dimensional space of invariant vectors is the K tangent space to the two face. Whereas if you take a look at the three branches in the discriminant locus coming into a vertex in the edge, then you get quite different behavior. Where you have a one-dimensional space of invariance instead of a two-dimensional space of invariance. And this holonomy is essentially just the transpose of the holonomy we saw earlier. And in fact, mirror symmetry is supposed to interchange these two different sorts of vertices. It just takes the transpose of the holonomy when you dualize the affine structure. And that's going to give you the interchange of these different sorts of vertices gives you quite a few features of mirror symmetry. Okay, so in this example, this goes back to 1999. These pictures were first seen in my work in 1999 and also Weidong Ron's paper at the same time. Sorry. So I proved that X-check of B0 can be compactified topologically to a quintic in this example, and X of B0 can be compactified topologically to a mirror quintic. So Weidong Ron proved some results in the symplectic category of a similar flavor, and since then there's been other work. Weidong also did some work with the hypersurface in toric varieties case, and then there's more recent work of Haas and Zarkov getting the affine structure in the hypersurface in toric variety case. And a recent paper of mine dealing with complete intersections in toric varieties, though in the context of testing a program that I've been working on with Berend Siebert, which I'm going to be talking about. But there's, at any rate, we know how to associate affine manifolds to every one of the complete intersection in toric variety cases of mirror symmetry. Okay, so what I'm now going to lead into is an introduction to the philosophy I've been taking for the last 3 years. So our basic difficulty, or the basic philosophy underlying mirror symmetry now, seems to suggest that affine geometry should be the underlying feature of mirror symmetry, that we should have affine geometry as something that can be interpreted in two ways. You either interpret it as giving you some complex geometry, or you interpret it as giving you some symplectic geometry. So we've already seen how the affine manifold gives you both a complex and a symplectic manifold. And then the hope is that various other structures on the affine manifold will give rise to various things on the complex or symplectic manifold you want to compute, such as Gronv-Witt invariants and so on. Okay, now the difficulty, as I said, we have, for example, already difficulties in compactifying the these complex manifolds in the complex category. So the program that Berend Siebert and I have been involved with for the last 3 years has been to introduce a new realm of geometry that's going to allow us to go between affine geometry and complex geometry, and namely introduce log geometry into the picture. So log schemes were invented by, the concept of log schemes were invented by Uzi Fontaine and Kazuo Kato. And I'm not going to define them in this talk. And what I'll do is I'll restrict to a simple two-dimensional case where one doesn't really need the full language of log schemes to talk about. But the basic idea is to try to build Calabi-Yaus out of simple pieces. And the data of the affine manifold will tell us how to do that. Okay, now, one of the ways of thinking about what we're trying to do, a number of ways, but kind of at the heart of this approach to thinking about mirror symmetry is an attempt to solve the following problem. So I think Kuncevich and Sobelman call this the reconstruction problem. I think of it as the compactification problem. If you're given the situation where you have an affine manifold B0 contained in B, how can we construct a complex manifold which is, very roughly speaking, should be a compactification of X of B0? Now, the difficulty is that X of B0 can't be compactified as a complex manifold. It just doesn't go. So what you're going to have to do is you're going to have to deform the complex structure a little bit in order to compactify it. Now, in order to make sense of that, you really need some notion of some asymptotic notion. So for example, you can define, let me modify the definition of X of B0 a bit by including a parameter epsilon. So let's define X epsilon of B0 to be the tangent bundle of B0 modulo epsilon times lambda, where epsilon you should think of as being small, heading towards zero. So that, of course, doesn't affect the topology of the manifold, but it does affect the complex structure. If you want, just think of an elliptic curve. If you take take a period of the elliptic curve being I epsilon, as epsilon goes to zero, of course, the complex structure is changing. And same here, the complex structure is changing. So then the basic problem is, can we find a family of compact complex manifolds, X epsilon of B, this is assuming B is compact, for epsilon sufficiently small, epsilon less than some epsilon zero, such that X epsilon of B is a compactification of X epsilon of B zero, after you deform the complex structure on X epsilon of B zero by a small amount. And the small amount which is healthy is something like order of e to the minus c over epsilon, where c is a constant. So that's very small compared to epsilon. So that's a refinement of this reconstruction question. Okay, so what I'm going to do is talk about the two-dimensional case. There was a recent paper of Kuncevich. Well, let me back up a bit. So the first work in this direction was Kenji Fukaya's work his paper on asymptotic analysis and somewhere here. It's very funny giving this lecture because I can't actually see any of you very clearly. It's a very strange experience. But anyway, so Kenji gave a heuristic ideas of how one might go about solving this problem. I think that is that accurate? That's heuristic. And then there was also this very recent paper of Kuncevich and Sobelman, which what they want to do is they want to do things in the with rigid analytic spaces, where life is sort of a bit easier because if you're trying to do analysis in rigid analytic spaces, it's somewhat easier than actually doing analysis in the genuine sense because you don't have to worry about convergence as much. And the structures they get look quite a lot like the structures that Kenji saw already in 2001. Now, without seeing those structures, or kind of proceeding a bit more crudely, I can solve this problem using the, along with Berndt, we can solve this problem using the methods that we've been developing. So I just thought that what I'd do is I'd focus the rest of the talk on how one can use our techniques to solve the problem in the K3 case. Now, the difference between what we do and what Kuncevich and Sobelman do is that I think in their approach is kind of very explicit. They tell you exactly how to go about constructing this rigid analytic space. Ours is somewhat less explicit. On the hand, we do actually get a family of complex manifolds out of it rather than just analytic space. The other thing we need is that we need to assume that B0 is actually integral. So this is a somewhat more restrictive situation where the transition maps are actually entirely integral. They're in the affine group of Zn rather than the affine group of Rn with integral linear part. Otherwise, the solution to the problem will in some sense be non-algebraic, and we're trying to use algebraic geometry to solve this problem. The examples I gave you were all satisfied this, so it will certainly work in the cases we're interested in. Okay, so here's a sketch of the construction. We want to start with an integral affine surface, B. Now, one point is that we can always rescale the affine coordinates by multiplying them by a large positive integer. And this only has the effect of changing, it doesn't change the torus bundle, and only has the effect of replacing this tangent bundle mod epsilon lambda by tangent bundle mod n epsilon lambda, so there's not a significant change in the complex structure either. We'll see why we want to do that in a minute. The other point is that because the affine structure is integral, there's a well-defined notion of an integral point in B0. So an integral point in B0 is a point whose affine coordinates are all integers. And that's well-defined because if you change the affine coordinates by an integral affine transformation, of course, it doesn't change the integrality of the coordinates. And the point we're going to want is that we want to choose this scaling big enough so that we have lots and lots of integral points to play with so we don't run out of them. Okay, so let's then start by taking our affine manifold B0 sitting inside B. So this isn't actually a sphere with measles. It's what I've done is I've drawn the sphere. The red axes denote the discriminant locus, and the blue points represent the integral points on B0. Now I'm going to make some assumptions about the nature of these singular points. So they should all be of this basic form. Of the sort of examples we saw in the K3 example, where the holonomy takes the form 1, 1, 0, 1. They should all be of this basic form. There are examples of more complicated singularities, and this construction will also work for some of them, but not all of them. Okay, so as I say, all singular points are of the standard form, given them examples. Now, one of the consequences of being in the standard form is that there is, through each singular point, a well-defined affine line. So remember, we had this holonomy, y1 goes to y1, y1 goes, y2 goes to y1 plus y2. So the equation y1 equals 0 is a well-defined equation on the affine manifold, whereas y2 equals 0 isn't well-defined because y2 itself isn't a well-defined coordinate. So through each of these singular points, we do have a well-defined line. And what we're going to do is we're going to just draw that line on the affine manifold and extend it until you reach an integral point on either side. Now, the fact that you can reach an integral point on either side is actually another bit of the structure of those singularities. I won't explain the details of why that's the case, but the local structure of the singularity says that there will be an integral point on that line in either direction. And again, if you've chosen the scaling high enough, you will have none of these lines will interact. You'll have integral points close enough to the singular points. So that's the first step. We draw these little lines. Okay, now I'm going to start to triangulate the manifold. The first thing I'll do just to so that we don't have to worry about the singularities very much, is I'll draw little triangles around picture says what I'm doing. Easier to look at the picture than to describe it. Just draw some triangles like that. So each one of these triangles should be a standard simplex. It should be affine isomorphic to the standard simplex in R2. So in particular, should well, standard simplex with coordinates 0, 0, 1, 0, and 0, 1. So again, as long as you have enough integral points around, you can draw these triangles. And so what's left over is just a affine manifold with a nice rectilinear boundary and no singular points. And it's not hard to then finish triangulating. So you finish triangulating the manifold and you get a picture like that. This is when I realize I've drawn far too many integral points. But anyway, it's possible to triangulate the manifold. All of the simplices you need to be standard, affine isomorphic to the standard simplex. That's absolutely crucial. And the reason for starting out by talking about these lines to the singular points is I need to have the right structure near the singular points. 24. As long as there's the standard form, will be 24. Okay, so now, take a look at one of the vertices of this triangulation. Well, if you look at the vertex very closely, so you don't see anything but the lines coming out of the vertex, it looks like you have a little fan, a fan in the toric geometry sense. So for every vertex, you have a corresponding fan in R2. So what we've done is we've triangulated using the standard simplex, and for every vertex we then get a fan sigma v, and hence a toric variety xv, so a two-dimensional toric variety. Now, in toric geometry, specifying a ray in a fan is the same thing as determining a divisor, a toric divisor, in the surface. So if you have an edge in this triangulation, it determines a ray, an edge VW, determines a ray in sigma V and a ray in sigma W, and hence it determines divisors, which I'll call DVW. You have a divisor DVW sitting inside XV and a divisor DVW sitting inside XW. These are both isomorphic to P1 in this case. And now what we're going to do is we're going to glue together XV and XW along this P1. So you should choose a gluing between choose a map between these two copies of P1, which is equivariant. So it should take the fixed points of the torus action. So that allows you to identify XV and XW along the divisor, and you then glue together. And this is going to give you, if you do all of these gluing specified by all of the edges, it's going to give you a very, possibly very complicated singular surface. So what you get is you glue these things together and you get a variety x0. And this is a variety with normal crossing, so it's locally. You either have just two surfaces meeting along a curve where the equations are locally given by x, y equals 0, or when corresponding to each triangle where you have three components meeting, you have locally behavior like x, y, z equals 0. Okay, now our goal is to smooth this singular variety, and this will give us our desired family of K3 surfaces. So the basic approach to trying to smooth this singular K3 surfaces, in this case, we can actually go back to some old results of Friedman, which tells us how to go about doing this. So what Friedman showed is that if you take this group x1 of omega 1 x0 with ox0, which is called N, he calls it ND, well, he defines this sheaf. This is a sheaf supported on a singular locus. In fact, in this normal crossings case, it's actually a line bundle on the singular locus of x0. If you don't like the x1, one way to think of this bundle is if x0 is actually sitting inside a smooth threefold, then nd is just the restriction of the normal bundle of x0 in that threefold to the singular locus of x0. Okay, so then Friedman's main result is that x0 is actually smoothable into a family of K3 surfaces if nd is actually isomorphic to OD. And what we know is that if we can actually get this smoothing, then we can prove without too much difficulty that a fiber, one of the smooth fibers of this family, smoothing x0, will be the compactification of x epsilon of b0 we're looking for. So our goal is actually to construct this smoothing. So there's a theorem there saying that that is the smoothing we want, but once that's not actually too hard to prove. Now, the problem is that in our particular example of x0, nd is definitely not trivial. It's not the structure sheaf OD. And the reason is, well, you can actually compute that if you restrict nd to one of these P1s corresponding to an edge, so where two of these surfaces intersect, then nd is trivial as long as the edge is disjoint from the singular locus. But it's actually OP1 of 1 if the edge intersects the discriminant locus, delta. So in other words, it's the singularities of this affine manifold which are getting in the way of applying this theorem directly. And the singularities are reflected in the sheaf ND. So in fact, we should have 24 curves in this in x0 where ND is actually non-trivial. Okay. Now, the first thing we need, so part of this big paper that I put out last year with Van Siebert, from there, there's a much more general theorem, but the special case for this K3 example says the following. You can actually construct a moduli space of pairs, x0 and s, where s is a section of nd, which is non-zero at every triple point. And very explicitly, this moduli space is a cohomology group of a sheaf on B. Is the sheaf, where you take, remember that system of lattices lambda, push it forward onto all of B. So if I is the inclusion of B0 into B, you just push forward lambda onto B by I lower star, and then you tensor with C star. And then you take the cohomology of that sheaf. Okay, well, it turns out that cohomology group is isomorphic to C star to the 20th. The 20 is, of course, the dimension that you expect for a moduli space of K3 surfaces. So that's kind of a good sign. The moduli space here, this involves not just the moduli of sections of ND, but also the moduli of possible gluings. Remember, we have a choice of gluings. All we have to do is choose equivariant gluings when we make the gluing along each P1. So we do have lots of possible gluings and lots of possible sections of ND. Now, the point is that once you're given such a pair, the section S of ND is going to have some zeros because ND is just O of 1 on some of these P1s. And those zeros give problems, and I want to resolve those problems as follows. So what we're going to do is we're going to modify x0 a little bit. So whenever you have two components of x0, say xv and xw, meeting along an edge corresponding to an edge in the triangulation with a singular point, s should have a zero somewhere along that P1. Corresponding P1. So whenever s as a 0 on xv intersect xw, we go through the following procedure. Here we have xv and xw glued along this p1. Take that apart. You still have the red, mark the 0 of s in red. You have these two components, xv and xw. We take them apart. And then you blow up one of the two points, either on the point on xv or the point on xw, where s was 0. You just blow that up to an ordinary blow-up, and then glue these two surfaces back together again, still using the same gluing that we had before. So what we've done is we've done a birational modification to x0, just introducing 24 new p1s by doing these blow-ups. So this gives us a x0 tilde. Which maps down birationally to x0, and there's a singular locus d contained in x0, and you have upstairs a singular locus d tilde, which is isomorphic to d under the projection. And the map from x0 tilde to x0 is 24 exceptional p1s. Well, then you can prove that now nd tilde is isomorphic to od tilde, so we do have this triviality condition that we need in Friedmann's theorem to be able to smooth. So x0 tilde can actually be smoothed, and now you get a flat family of K3 surfaces, x tilde to s. And then you can show that hiding in this family is the K3 surface that we want, namely one that will be a compactification of a small deformation of x epsilon of b0. Okay, so ideally we would like to do this in all dimensions. At the moment, we still have some problems. So first of all, the structure of the singularity is on B in higher dimensions because, of course, now we have, for example, three dimensions, the discriminant locus is a set of curves or a graph. The structure of the singularities of B actually forces some restriction on the sort of polyhedral decomposition we can use. So I decompose my two-sphere into a bunch of standard two-symplices. That's relatively easy to work with. In higher dimensions, we can't always do that. There are restrictions caused by the singularities which force us to use, in our polyhedral decompositions, force us to use more complicated polyhedra. And as a result, when you build x0, again by gluing together all these toric varieties, you don't get something normal crossing. So that's what actually forces us into the realm of full-strength log geometry. Log geometry is something that makes things like normal crossing varieties actually look smooth, is really the moral of the story. But log geometry allows worse singularities than just normal crossings. And we have to use the full strength of log geometry in order to actually even work in higher dimensions. The second problem is that you still get a bad set on x0. So you had this bad set where the section s was 0. And that causes some problems. And we don't have the same techniques in higher dimensions where we can just blow up something in order to get resolution of this problem. As a result, we have to develop a deformation theory for log schemes with these sorts of certain sorts of singularities appearing in them. And that also seems to be very technical, which is slowing us down. But what we do have, again, this is, well, the first item here is in our in my big paper with Ferenc from last year. We do get mirror symmetry for logarithmic Calabi-Yau spaces. So working just on these singular Calabi-Yau varieties built up by as unions of toric varieties, we do get a nice theory of mirror symmetry for those. We get a nice isomorphism between Kähler moduli spaces and complex moduli spaces. We have explicit descriptions of the complex moduli spaces. And you get a form of mirror symmetry using a discrete form of the Legendre transform. So you replace the notion of the potential function of the metric with a piecewise linear convex function. And you're able to do a discrete Legendre transform with respect to that piecewise linear convex function. And as a result, you're able to emulate what we were doing in the case of the SYZ conjecture to dualize the affine structure on these affine manifolds. And that actually allows you to get a mirror symmetry construction. And it is, I've now shown in this paper I released this year in 2004, that this mirror symmetry construction using the discrete Legendre transform does reproduce, in particular, the Batterov-Borisov complete intersection construction. So you can do mirror symmetry in this way. In particular, it really is just a form of SYZ construction, dualizing affine structures. We also have some approaches to attacking the smoothing problems in higher dimensions. I don't think I have time to talk about that. And also, Baron Siebert has some approaches to sort of connecting things like Gromov-Witten invariants with tropical geometry on B. So that's our ultimate goal, is to really understand mirror symmetry by understanding what structures on these affine manifolds give you Gromov-Witten invariants on one side and have to do with variations of Hodge structure periods on the other side. That will be the ultimate goal. And one understands that, and one really understands what mirror symmetry is about. OK, that's all. So. I haven't understood how to do that, if there is a direct relationship or not. But no, I can't answer your question. No, there's no. The metric isn't visible here in this construction. Oh, well, the triviality of the canonical bundle is just orientability of B. So that's easy. Because you can write down explicitly on X of B0, you can write down a holomorphic N form explicitly as long as B is orientable. No, so the construction I've done is kind of crude in the sense that these points, these singular points, are actually free to move along those invariant lines I drew. And I don't really care exactly where they appear. You know, obviously, if you move the points a bit too far, say past an integral point, then you get some sudden change in the construction. That kind of represents a birational change in construction. But this construction isn't sensitive to small changes of location of those points. So as a result, you don't see that moduli. What you do see is the moduli in the sort of the rest of the moduli of affine structures. So you get 24 moduli for moving those points. You have 20 additional moduli, and that's what comes is the moduli of the K3 surface. No, we're trying to do that, but we don't have any answers. But you there's no such affine manifold.
Oh, you wouldn't have been able to. So sort of, you started out with a rate. So
you need
I guess if you start out, let's say, three S3, you just tried to try any old discriminant function.
Yeah.
Suppose, well, then, how do you know whether the result is?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that you need to place an affine structure on the complement. And that's, a priori, can be quite difficult. So, I mean, there's a theorem of Conan and Margot Symington, which says that if you have an affine surface with these sorts of singularities, then, right. You know, in order for it not to have a boundary, it has to have 24. Right, yeah.
In higher dimensions,
we... Yeah, I don't know what restrictions are. I'm sure that there are lots of restrictions, but
some factor.
Okay.